Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This will certainly have an adult theme and might well contain strong scenes of sex or violence, which could be quite graphic. It may also contain some very explicit language, which will frequently mean sexual swear words.
What do you like this to say?
Chart music.
Chart music.
You pop-crazed youngsters, and welcome to part 3 of episode 73 of Chart Music, which finds us, that is to say, Simon Price, Sarah B, and me, Al Needham, stuck in the middle of an episode of Top of the Pops, dated March the 4th, 1993. And there is absolutely no opportunity for a fanny about, so let us rejoin the episode in progress.
All of that, Eve, that's Mark coming on Top of the Pops. Now, we were due to have Sway playing live on the show tonight, but unfortunately, Brett is not feeling too well. Brett, what's the matter?
I think my voice has deserted me. I've been singing too violently on stage.
Hey, listen, get well soon. We wish you all the very best. Here's the video, though. New entry at number 7, Animal Nitrate.
We cut to a tight shot of Franklin on an empty stage, who tells us that the next act were supposed to be here in the studio tonight, but are not. And as the camera pulls back, we see a very pouty young man with his arms tightly folded, looking out upon the kids with barely concealed contempt. Brett Anderson. Franklin asks him why his band aren't playing, and he says, "I think my voice has deserted me. I've been singing too violently." Fucking hell. This has got serious come to the front of assembly and explain how you've let the school down vibes, hasn't it? Who's made him do this and why?
I can only assume that the decision was made quite late in the day, because those curtains that we see on the stage, those sort of ruched dark red silk drapes, are from the Animal Nitrate video.
And
so clearly they were planning to recreate their little world, you know, their sort of video world on the Top of the Pop stage. It was, you know, they were going to make it their domain, and it was all set up ready to go. In terms of why it might have happened, I did look at their tour dates, and it turned out that they had just finished touring their debut album about 3 days earlier in Cambridge. And far be it from me to speculate as to, you know, what kind of celebrating they might have done at the end of that tour, but that might possibly have something to do with the fact that Brett's voice is apparently fucked.
Hey, listen, get well soon, says Franklin, and gently shoves him out of shot and introduces the video to Animal Nitrate by Suede. Formed in London in 1989 by Justine Frischman, her boyfriend Brett Anderson and Matt Osman, Suede started playing covers until they realised that neither of them were much cop on guitar. And in October of 1989, they placed an advert in the NME which read, "Young guitar player needed for London-based band Smiths, Commotions, Boer, Pet Shop Boys, No Musos, some things are more important than ability, call Brett," which led to them being joined by Bernard Butler. After a series of gigs with a drum machine in late 1989, they sent off a demo to Gary Crowley, who was presenting a show called Demo Clash on Greater London Radio, and their song Wonderful Sometimes won 5 weeks in a row, leading them to sign a deal with the Brighton-based independent label RML and the song appearing on a compilation cassette. But a debut double A-side single was scrapped when the band didn't like it, and almost all of the 500 copies were destroyed. After being let down by the drum machine one gig too many, they finally put an advert in the Enemy for a drummer and were astonished to get a reply from Mike Joyce, who'd been looking to get back into the game after the Smiths split up, but both parties realised it'd be a bad idea and they went for Simon Gilbert on the recommendation of their manager at the time, Ricky Gervais. After Frischmann and Anderson split up, and the former was thrown out of the band after she started going out with Damon Albarn and turned up late for a rehearsal because she'd been at a Blur video shoot, they began 1992 being touted about as the best unsigned band in the country. Nude Records, a London independent, got in first with a two-single deal, and a week before the first one came out, The Drowners, they were on the cover of Melody Maker billed as the best new band in Britain, which helped get the single up to number 49 in May of that year. This single, their third, is the follow-up to Metal Mickey, which got to number 17 in September of 1992. It's also the third cut from their debut LP, Suede, which comes out at the end of the month. And this week, it's smashed into the charts at number 7, this week's highest new entry. Oh, fucking hell. Where do we begin, chaps?
I just think this is where the episode begins.
Yeah.
This is
yeah.
when it yes. gets exciting. My heart skipped, I'll be honest, when I saw Brett standing there. In this episode, immediately yeah. I thought, that is a pop star. I mean, fucking hell. Just
it looks like he's going to go into a full Riggs Bear of the kids, which would have been fucking mint.
My God.
Yes.
He's totally in character, isn't he? It's like just for that very brief moment. And he's yeah. contorting himself like an angle-poised lamp in leather.
Yes.
It's really funny as well because he has like a poker straight posture in real life. Like he's just cocked everything to make his body into an S shape for sweat. Wade.
Yes.
And it's like, fucking hell, Brett, whatever's happened to your throat is nothing compared to what's happening to your vertebra.
Suede are one of our bands. And when you see one of our bands on a Top of the Pop stage, their expression and the look on their face is usually, what the fuck am I doing here? But with Brett Anderson, it's, what the fuck are you doing here? You, the presenter, you, the kids, you, the camera crew, what are you yeah. doing here looking at me?
He's giving Mark Franklin serious side eye, isn't
oh,
he?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, basically almost rolling his eyes, like, you know, what the fuck?
Yeah, this is the kind of shit you've got to do when you're a fucking massive band like we are. I mean, amazingly, Suede meant nothing to me at the time, bar a few clips of their videos on the chart show on a Saturday morning. And, you know, they'd come on for 10 seconds and I'd go, oh, this is interesting. But, you know, obviously being a hip-hop boy, not interested enough to make me investigate them more. And shamefully, this lot are a complete black hole to me.
Oh, well.
I was interested to see what your take was going to be, Al, because I kind of predicted, 60/40, that you were going to fucking hate them.
No, not at all. It was just like, all right, is this what that lot are getting up to now? Okay, it's an advance on fucking Ned's Atomic Dustbin and the Wonder Stuff.
Right. That lot meaning kind of indie rock fans.
Yes.
Or whatever. Yeah, right, okay.
Yeah, it's like, oh, okay, so we're being inspired, again, being inspired by the early 70s, but the good early 70s, you know, Bowie and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, we said, didn't we, that 1993 was kind of a fallow year. And I think Suede could only have manifested in one of those, a kind of liminal space between scenes. And they've said that they are a band about the liminal spaces. Liminal space rock. Brett is pretty much from one of those, like growing up in a council house between a woodland and a tip. It's like, that's perfect.
Brett of the dump.
Exactly. If they were a time of day, they'd be gloaming. If they were a body part, they'd be a dip in a clavicle, but that doesn't mean that they're in any way undefined. Like, it's startling from this video and also just from that couple of seconds of Brett looking like a vampire bat that's kind of accidentally hung himself on a washing line, he's just trying to style it out. It's startling how clearly swayed they are right away. And the strength and the confidence of the aesthetic that they are presenting is so striking. It's a bit messy and it's slightly rough around the edges, but fucking hell. You just see it, don't you? You go, fucking hell.
Yes.
So, Simon, you were at Melody Maker at the time. Melody Maker putting them on the cover saying, here's the best new band in Britain. Did you have a hand in that?
Yeah, I was there quite a long time before that. In fact, my backstory with Suede goes way beyond them being Suede even.
Right.
There are so many weird coincidences, okay? First of all, Brett was born 4 days after me.
Right.
He grew up in Haywards Heath. I went for 2 years to a school that was just outside Haywards Heath.
Right.
We then both ended up at UCL, University College London, at the same time.
Ooh.
And wow. I remember him knocking about, right? And I only realised it was him in hindsight. I did a lot of work at the student union, UCL union, because we had a mobile disco set up and we used to make a bit of money for ourselves and for the union by allowing the mobile disco to be hired out to sometimes to sort of private outsiders, hotels and so on, and sometimes to the departments of the university and various societies.
Right.
We had it all on a massive trolley stolen from Euston Station, the whole setup. And one time we were hired, and I was hired to do it by the architecture department. And I think either Justine or Brett, I think it might have been Justine, was a student at the architecture department. And I went along there and I set up in the sort of common room there. And I remember this couple, and the guy had this bright yellow duffel coat, coming up to me and just hassling me for David Bowie all night. I really vividly remember that. And they were pissing me off a little bit, actually. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it was only afterwards I read an interview where Brett was talking about hanging around UCL in this bright yellow duffel coat. I thought, fucking hell, it was him all along.
At least he didn't ask you for any Oasis, Simon. Yeah, probably because they weren't
didn't exist
around
yet. Yeah, exactly.
No.
So by the time I got to Melody Maker, when Suede sort of changed from being shitty Bull and Gate also rans to being Suede. I was editing a section in the paper called Preview, which was stuff about film and TV and comics and all that, which I think I mentioned earlier. A colleague of mine, Ian Watson, was running the section called Advance, confusingly similar kind of names. And Advance was where we wrote about brand new bands.
Right.
And he handed me a cassette tape one day and said to me, Simon, I think you're going to like this.
Ooh.
And it was a Suede demo tape, 4 tracks on it, which included The Drowners and Metal Mickey and a couple of the B-sides. So basically their first 2 singles. And I played it, and the recording wasn't great quality, but the fucking songs, man, they were so good. It was one of those things, you get a demo tape, and I was just playing that over and over more than I was playing my actual record collection.
Yeah.
It was very Bowie, very Smiths, but I was in the market for a bit of that. So this was good editing, by the way, by Ian Watson. He could have taken it himself. He could have thought, well, this band's obviously going to be huge. I'm going to do it. But he knew that it was right up my street, and he gave it to me.
Bless him.
Yeah, I went to a rehearsal studio in Hackney, and I met them, and I interviewed them. I gave them their first bit of coverage in the sort of mainstream weekly music press under the headline Pigskin Heads. and the thing with it is, Steve Sutherland, the assistant editor of Melody Maker, then jumped on board really quickly, and he re-interviewed them soon afterwards.
Oh.
And yeah, and he slapped them on the front cover of Melody Maker with the infamous headline, "The Best New Band in Britain." And I feel like I'm being fucking written out of history and also gaslit by the fact that everybody thinks that was their first coverage.
No, let's set the record straight right here.
Yeah, on an old laptop, I've got the JPEG of that original Pigskin Heads piece, in which I talk about the fact that they all dress in charity shop clothes and they've got kind of Brian Ferry hairstyles and just this really distinct aesthetic, this sort of very 1970s aesthetic that nobody had at the time.
Yeah.
But even the official Suede biography, Love and Poison by David Barnett, which I had a hand in, I was actually slated to co-write that, and I actually did a bit of preliminary work on it,
right,
and I sort of I backed out in the end. But even that book just skims over the fact that I wrote the first interviews.
No.
Oh, Jesus Christ. The thing with The Best New Band in Britain, which is a really bold thing to say. And I love the fact that Melody Maker did that. But we kind of bottled it. I don't know if you've seen that front cover, but it's a right fucking patchwork. Suede are at the top of the cover, and it says the best new band in Britain. But we hedged our bets by also having, and this is from memory because I haven't seen it in a while, but Thousand Yard Stare and EMF also on the cover. Oh. And it's like, if you're going to say an unknown band is the best new band in Britain, fucking say it.
Yeah.
Fucking just put a picture of them and that headline and dare the world to deal with that. Mm. Don't say, oh, but never mind, you might like EMF or, you know, that kind of fucked me off.
Yeah, that was the fundamental difference between Melody Maker and the NME. The NME would put up one massive image for their cover with a little bit of something on the side, whereas Melody Maker would just seemingly throw everything at the cover. And sorry, mate, but the NME's covers always look better.
No, you're right. Our front cover design wasn't great, and I apologise if any of my colleagues in the art department are listening, but they weren't that great. The thing that NME had in its favour, though, was that they never really had to break new bands. Mm. That was our job.
Yeah.
So by the time NME put somebody on the cover, they are already big enough to carry a front cover.
Yeah.
So NME would never have really had that dilemma. Mm. Sometimes they would go out on a limb and put fucking things like Terrace, do you remember them, on the front cover?
Kingmaker.
Yeah, but mostly our job was to be the sort of talent scouts, the sort of A&R department of IPC. Mm. And our strapline became Tomorrow's Music Today after a while, because basically you've got two magazines that are very similar in the same building, under the same publishing house, one floor above or below each other, sharing the same fucking ad department and everything. So we had to differentiate ourselves somehow. Just from a publishing point of view, it made no sense for IPC to have those two papers. So we had to kind of try and put some clear water between us and NME.
Yeah.
So we became the paper that discovered bands. And so it was with Suede. We put ourselves out on a limb, not far enough out on a limb as far as I'm concerned, but we did it. And then by the time NME did, it's like, well, you know, Brett is really famous by now.
But anyway, the video, because that's what we get. And it's absolutely sodden with 90s video cliches that aren't actually cliches yet in 1993. We get an interior of ruched velvet curtains with a carpet very similar to the one in The Shining, with clips of the rest of the band, so their glossy hair tosses about just so. And that's punctuated with shots of a very skinny lead singer slouching around the Lisson Green estate in Westminster. And we get a bit of artiness as well with someone wearing a pig's head, because hey, it's 1993, everyone.
Yeah. And that ties in with the record sleeve as well. There's a sort of illustration of somebody in a suit wearing a pig head.
Yes.
Yeah, I love that they did that. There was that kind of continuation. It were, these things always matched, you know. It was always
Well, that's the thing. Suede had their worlds. They created a world. Mm. And this is something that when I wrote that very first piece, that's what I was trying to get across, that they had a very, very distinct aesthetic. And they even had their own lexicon. You know, the lyrics were all about council homes, nuclear skies, acid rain, loveless bum sex and that kind of stuff, you know. And they're inviting you into this world that only they are writing about, really, in pop. And they'd obviously put so much thought into it. They actually owe it all to Top the Pops. I found out from the aforementioned book, which is actually a good book despite the fact that it tried to write me out of history, Love and Poison, that they were sitting around pre-record deal watching an episode of Top the Pops in October 1989, actually, and it made them get serious about Suede, because they just thought, this is fucking awful. We've got to do something.
Right.
Because I think they were kind of a bit of a baggy adjacent band to begin with. If you see the way they dressed, Brett wearing these sort of like loose tops and beads around his neck and that kind of stuff, they did look a bit like a sort of, I don't know, almost a candy flip kind of act. Do you know what I mean?
Oh dear.
if you look at photos, I didn't see them in that time, so I can't say if that actually crossed over into their music at all. But they obviously just had a complete rethink and thought, no, fuck it. We're going to have our own world, our own aesthetic. We're going to look like the dodgy uncles out of a 70s sitcom, and we are gonna do our hair like Brian Ferry, and we are gonna sing like Bowie. And if anybody says, oh, you're ripping off Bowie, fuck it, we're just gonna do it.
Yeah, just like the 80s then.
Well, yeah, exactly. Fucking love them for that. I really do.
It's impossible to imagine Suede as baggy when they are so tight.
Yeah.
They just went the polar opposite of baggy in so many ways. I mean, Brett really puts in a shift in this video, doesn't he?
Yes.
Like, this is a man who has considered how this is going to look at every level and how he is going to look. It's such a performance, and I'm sure it's been refined in the edit, which is extremely good. But he's really giving it everything. There is a python at some point.
Oh, is that?
And Brett does, in fact, several times, like a snake, unhinge his entire lower jaw. like a python swallowing an egg. I mean, that might be something to do with the things that they have said they took that got them through the day. Also, it's not, you know, it's easier to say that, isn't it? It's not that he's gurning, he's performing, you know. And he's so coquettish and girlish and weird and kind of awkward and sexy, and it's very moody, and he's like a moody teenage girl kind of slouching around the council estate and then kind of talking to a pig's head and caressing it and then punching it. Kind of there's a bit where he just turns to look at the camera with this sort of quizzical look on his face and turns the pig's head at the same time. It's great. It's just the video, it's just kind of strobing at you all these signifiers of what they want to be and what they want to be about. And we've said, you know, that it's beyond an aesthetic into iconography, isn't it, really? Also, there's a lovely dog. It's a Doberman, and they throw him the pig effigy at the end, because there's kind of, there's the pig's head, and then there's like a guy, like a bonfire night guy with a pig's head on it, and they throw that to the dog, and the dog goes, yeah, rah, rah, rah. Possibly unintentionally hilarious, but yeah.
Yeah, Sarah's absolutely right about the possible reasons why Brett is putting in such a shift, as it were, because, this is mentioned in the biography, that the director, Pedro Romagny, just gave him loads of cocaine, because the first two takes they did of the video were a bit subdued and a bit boring, and he just thought, no, sorry, fuck this, you know, yeah, get this up your nostrils, and off they go, yeah.
They have got worked up to performance pitch, haven't they?
Yeah, definitely.
I think that Brett appearing on Top of the Pops momentarily, and that was obviously, you know, a fuck up that they didn't want, but it's not just that he styles it out. I think he's confident that the video is no less. It's not like, oh, sorry, we can't perform for you live, or have the video as consolation. Like, the video is as good, you know.
Yeah,
you're not losing anything.
It's actually their second Top of the Pops appearance, if you can call it an appearance, because the first one was for Metal Mickey, and they were mortally drunk on that occasion, and Brett repeatedly slapping his ass with a microphone, of course, that was his trademark.
Yes.
And they were the first unsigned band to appear on Top of the Pops, despite what Biss might tell you, because they'd actually fulfilled the two single deal they had with Nude Records, but they decided to stick with Nude in the end. So basically, when they were on Top of the Pops, they didn't have a record deal. Oh, by the way, the the guy in the pig mask who's sitting in a kind of mastermind type black leather swivel chair, I've sat in that chair.
Oh. Did you put the pig's head on as well?
God, this really goes deep, doesn't it? Fucking hell.
Did you sniff it, Simon?
Did I sniff the pig?
No, the chair.
well, here's the thing. The chair had previously belonged to Brett, and Brett moved house and didn't have room for it anymore. So he gave it to David Barnett, the author of the biography, who was also running the Suede fan club at the time.
Right.
David was living with Errol Alkan, the well-known DJ, who was also a mate of mine, in a flat above a shop on Fortis Road in Tuffnell Park. And I lived just around the corner. So, you know, occasionally I'd end up there and sitting on that chair. And it was one of those chairs where, you know, you can imagine these mastermind chairs. You're sitting on a black leather cushion, but the cushion is stitched down. You can't pick the cushion up as such, but you can kind of get your hands round the outside of it.
Right.
And in the crease round the outside of it, they would often find just ecstasy pills from when it was Brett's chair. And they just, you know, Brett and his mates had just casually sort of scattered or lost a load of, you know, ease down the side of it.
Good Lord.
Yeah, so I've sat on that chair.
Did it give you a sense of enormous well-being?
Around the arse.
Yeah.
But even the video and Top of the Pops airing it has caused problems, as a news article in this week's NME bears out. Headline: Chart Show Kissed Off with Suede.
Right.
Suede's video for Animal Nitrate was pulled from last Saturday's Chart Show amidst allegations that producers objected to a scene depicting two men kissing.
Oh, my God.
The video was shown on Friday's late night show, which is only screened in the London area, but was mysteriously absent from the version which appeared the following lunchtime. A spokesperson for the chart show denied that any kind of censorship was imposed. He told the NME, "We just didn't like the video." When asked why, in that case, the promo featured on the previous night's programme, he retorted, "We make a children's TV programme." A spokesperson for the band declined to comment on the story. I mean, obviously, that scene's been removed. But fucking hell, Suede have just made Top of the Pops come off as more daring than the chart show.
Yeah.
Anything else to say?
Oh, yeah, quite a lot.
Oh, fucking hell, we're not even spoke about the song yet. Jesus.
The thing with Animal Nitrate is, it is a song about domestic abuse, just like the Marksman song was. It's about loveless chem sex and bumming, basically, because the refrain, kind of the chorus, "Now you're over 21, seems to be a reference to what was then the gay age of consent, of course.
It actually dates it perfectly to this year, because the age of homosexual consent was lowered to 18 the following year, in 1984. Right. It was in the Criminal Justice Act, which I should point out, having slagged it off earlier for good reason. It's not all bad. And also, it would have been lowered to 16 at that time, if Edwina Curry's amendment had succeeded. So,
right.
So yeah. There you go.
Do you reckon the government were thinking, well, we could keep the age of consent as it is, but that guy from Suede seems really angry about it.
Yeah.
Better listen to the kids, you know.
Yes.
The thing with Suede and queerness is a controversial issue, because they got a lot of stick at the time. There was the interview where Brett said that he considered himself a bisexual man who'd never had a homosexual experience. Mm. And people ripped the fucking shit out of him for that, saying that he was co-opting gay culture when he had no right to.
Yeah.
And that Suede were just straight boys faking it. The thing is, the least gay-looking member of the band was the gay member of the band, and that's Simon Gilbert, the drummer.
Yeah. Right.
And I knew him kind of before he was in Suede as well, because
having gay sex with him.
Al.
Oh, come on,
Jesus.
Simon. Open
That's
goal,
beneath
man.
You. And don't make a joke about beneath you either. in addition to doing stuff at UCL Union, I was doing quite a lot of work at ULU, the University of London Union, for the whole uni, which is down the road, and that's the place that Ricky Gervais was the boss of, and it's where Ricky and I used to put gigs on and stuff like that. And Ricky was basically running Suede out of that office.
Right.
But downstairs in the lobby, there were two things. There was STA, Student Travel Association, sort of cheap holidays, Interrail tickets and all that. And there was this tiny little booth where you could buy gig tickets, mostly gigs at ULU itself. Because do you remember the days when to get a ticket, you actually had to go somewhere
and
fucking, you know, pay with money or a credit card or whatever. There was one down by Oxford Circus
times.
Station. Yeah. But Simon Gilbert was just sat there all fucking day. So I was on kind of nodding terms, or, you know, speaking terms with him already. And he was the gay member. No one thought it was him, because he had sort of like short, spiky ginger hair, you know, a bit like Johnny Rotten. They thought, well, he's obviously not gay. It was kind of hiding in plain sight.
Didn't have a handbag or anything.
Yeah, exactly. But all these people sort of just really, really attacking Suede for being, I suppose, tourists, sexual tourists, were bang wrong. They just completely missed the point.
Simon, weren't you in the building when Brett Anderson said that?
Was I?
Well, I believe you were. That quote came from a massive interview.
Debate at Melody Maker?
The sex debate. When Melody Maker did the sex issue.
Yeah,
which was quite the thing to do in the 90s. Yeah, it's had Brett Anderson on the cover, seemingly having his head eaten by Leslie out of Silverfish. It wasn't
Leslie out of Silverfish, yeah. Boy George was there as well.
Yeah.
I mentioned during the course of the debate that I actually wasn't gay or bisexual myself.
Mm.
And afterwards, Boy George came up to me just like, no way, man. He was like, he was convinced I was gay. He couldn't believe it. I was really proud of that. I thought, fucking hell, Boy George, the king or the queen of gays, thinks that I'm a gay. I thought, yes, that's kind of cool, you know. Yeah.
I think there's a lot to suggest that, you know, queerness is, it's a very, there are people who think that you, this is not a word you should use still, but there are other people who think that the umbrella is quite big, you know, and it refers more to a sort of general way of life than just sexuality. Also, I think Brett's comment, I mean, he has kind of rode back on it since, and I think it was slightly, the wording may have been slightly clumsy, but it's not actually a controversial statement, because the stereotype is that, you know, in order to be certified bisexual, one must have at least one other person of another gender hanging off you as you go about your business, you know, you, like, you have to collect them like psych tokens. But actually, you don't. You know, it's people know what their sexuality is before they have any sexual experience.
Exactly.
At all, a lot of the time, or they discover it later, or they change their mind, or, you know, whatever.
Yes.
I think if somebody said that today, it wouldn't make a ripple, would it?
I mean, fair play to a band for blurring the lines and all that.
Yeah.
It does come off like them using the first term of uni who put about this lie that they're, oh, I just don't know. Am I gay? Am I not? You know, in an attempt to make them more interesting and convertible to girls, which is what my mate with the playing cards also did. Shame on him.
There's quite a bit about them at this point that is affected and sort of arch, you know, a little bit. But
which
I think
brilliant.
All that very quickly.
Yeah.
But I think, but it's a little possibly slightly too far, in the same way that Brett's voice is this kind of spiky bark at this point, because he hasn't quite, you know, worked it. Like, by the time they did Dogman Star, it's kind of, he's worked it down a bit more into his chest, and there's a song, you know. So it's got a little bit more room there. It's kind of moved it down from the kind of bedsit esophagus to the sort of studio apartment of the ribs. I think the sort of that edge that was a little bit too sharp, they didn't lose the sharpness, but it kind of burned off a bit, like alcohol in a sauce, you know, but it kept them from ever being jarringly earnest.
This song, it sounds like a really obvious single. It's got that chorus, oh, you know, it's a real sort of sing-along thing. Incredibly, it nearly wasn't a single. They wanted to put Sleeping Pills from the album out instead,
right?
But then they wrote this song quite late on in the process of making the album, and Saul Galpin from Nude Records said, no, come on, that's the single. And it just seems mad now that it was ever not going to be the single.
Yeah, you can't imagine it, can you?
It's a phenomenal record. I really think it's just gobsmacking piece of work, it really is. Animal Nitrate felt important. Jane Savage, who was their PR person at the time, sent a cassette of it sellotaped to a velvet cushion to the NME on a motorbike. I don't recall Melody Maker receiving one, which is, you know, I'm a bit pissed off about that. And Select magazine gave a whole page to the single, separate from the usual singles page, about a month before it even came out. It was like, this is too important to be on the singles page. This song has to have a feature about it right now. And they started, Select magazine listed it among their singles of the year before it was even a single, before it was even out. So yeah, it felt like an event. It felt very important. And of course, this wasn't even the only time that a mainstream primetime television audience had seen Animal Nitrate that year, because three weeks earlier, they're on the Brit Awards, 16th of February 1993. And to me, Suede doing Animal Nitrate on the Brits is right up there with KLF, with their Machine Guns and Sheep's Heads, or Jarvis versus Jacko, or any of that. It felt like a real fucking moment. Sadly, the entire episode isn't out there anywhere, I don't think, on the internet, but the Suede clip is. And Richard O'Brien, who was hosting, introduces them as the already legendary Suede. And you can just see all the industry suits sat there in their fucking tuxedos. It's like a black tie event, completely bemused, while Brett goes on there and slaps his ass with a microphone, trashes the microphone stand. The band drop their instruments and walk off at the end. Brilliantly, right? Bernard Butler went on stage with his coat. He takes off his coat to play the song. Then he put his guitar down and put his coat back on before leaving the stage. Yeah. I love that.
The movement that did feel the benefit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Bernard Butler, we haven't really talked about him, but
no.
Obviously he's the guy who answered the ad in NME, and he is a fucking musical genius. And he turns up, and apparently what he said to them, because they were about 25, the rest of them, and he was 22, you know, he went along to sort of audition, and he said to them, how old are you then? And they go, well, we're 25. And he said, well, you better hurry up then, haven't you? Which I fucking love. No, you old bastards of 25.
Yeah, yeah.
This performance at the Brits, Suede were the only alternative band on the bill.
Right.
I mean, Al, you spoke about our bands, as it were, from a Melody Maker perspective. It felt very punk. To give you some context, I've got the rest of the lineup here from that year. So performing were Andy Bell and KD Lang doing No More Tears, Enough Is Enough.
Right.
Madness doing Night Boat to Cairo. Peter Gabriel doing Steam.
What, the E17 song? God.
Rod Stewart doing a cover version of Ruby Tuesday.
Ooh.
And then Sway doing Animal Nitrate. And Tasmin Archer doing Sleeping Saturday. Right. Right? The winners that year, right? Annie Lennox, obviously, because them's the rules.
Yes.
Right? Take That, Shakespeare's Sister, Peter Gabriel, Mick Hucknall, Annie Lennox again, Simply Red again, Rod Stewart, Prince, okay, Prince, R.E.M., yeah, okay, R.E.M., Nirvana, yeah, all right, Nigel fucking Kennedy, and Wayne's World. It's broadly very establishment, very mainstream. So, honestly, I can just vividly remember to see Suede breaking out of their usual context, which was still kind of the 100 Club or the Africa Centre, like little venues, and storming the Brits felt like a real invasion.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's of a piece with everything else about them, with the video and with Brett standing there next to Mark Franklin. It's very arresting and striking and whoa, you know, and it really sort of knocks you back in your seat in a really good way. Mm. Although possibly not for the people who were there on the night. It's, you can feel there's kind of no air in the room at all, and it doesn't affect them whatsoever. There's no self-consciousness. There's just, they're there to do what they do. They're there to be Suede, and it is quite mind-boggling.
What about you, Al?
Well, you know me, Simon. This sort of thing, it wasn't going to be my cup of tea. But to see that lot doing what they're doing amongst fucking Annie Lennox and Rod Stewart. And I just thought, well, you know, there's a lot worse of this sort of thing knocking about. And if this is going to be the coming thing, then good, bring it on. You know, to paraphrase the parlance of the day, I might not like it, but I'm going to have to go along with it.
Ich nicht und lichten. Yeah, yeah. So I looked in Love and Poison, the biography, to see what was going on behind the scenes at the Brit Awards, which took place at Alexandra Palace. And John Aidman, who was their manager at the time, says, everyone was really nervous and we got given a big old Winnebago thing, which we sat in all day. I think they de-stressed themselves by changing their clothes a lot and Brett recurringly asking me for a hairdryer. I went to the production office and they were having share problems because she was only take her water in small bottles and they bought big ones.
Amateurs.
So the bloke from Suede's hairdryer was not the major concern. I love that. So first of all, Cher being really kind of Spinal Tap about about the format in which her water has to be served. And then apparently when they go on stage, Charlie Charlton, who was of the management team and then later became their manager, apparently knocked Bernard's guitar when he handed it to him. Ooh. So the guitar was all out of tune. They go on, he's got to play. So he plays, and so it sounds a bit ragged, and that's why. And there was a guy doing the sound for them who'd never done their sound before. So it's all a bit shambolic. It was all fucked. And the theory that Charlie has is that Brett just sensed this and just really fucking went for it, because he's like, we're going to sound terrible. I've got to leave them with something to remember. So he goes into full arse-slapping mode.
Yes.
The party afterwards was in a specially made fun fair, because that's what the Brit Awards is like. And they took a load of ecstasy, because that was their thing, as well as coke at the time. They're all on a high after what they thought was just this mind-blowing television moment, right? And Saul Galpin's mum, Saul being the boss of Nude Records, Saul's mum phoned him up to commiserate. She said, "Oh, Saul, I'm so sorry. I've just seen Suede on the Brits. Are you okay?" She thought his career was finished and Suede were finished. Oh. And he had to tell her, "That was the greatest moment of my life."
I suppose we got to talk about the lyrics because, fucking hell. You wouldn't want to explain them to your nonna, would you?
So I don't know if I've said this before about using the second person. So it's written in the second person, which gives a certain immediacy, but it also gives you a certain distance. It's like often when, you're taking I out of it and you're putting a sort of little grass verge there that could protect you or give you a few steps away to make sense of things, or reaching for something universal. It's like I noticed a while ago, and you're going to notice it too now, that when people are interviewed by news after some traumatic incident, immediately or later, they very often use you when speaking about what happened, and they'll switch mid-sentence from first to second person. Mm. Like, the lightning struck me and it was like you were being burned all along your veins, you know. Mm. It's like stepping out of your own harrowing experience to help yourself. And it's also stepping towards the person who's asking you about it, sort of invite them to understand.
Yeah.
Imagine if you were struck by lightning. Imagine yourself as me, you know. So there's that. But there's also, it's probably just that he was writing in a kind of omniscient storytelling position. I mean, I just think it's a great use of the second person. It sort of adds this layer of discomfort and accusation. But I think it can also be interpreted as stealth first person. Because I kind of, you know, I know the song really well. And it's like, it's such a bop, you know, and it's got such dark subject matter that it's like, okay, I haven't really thought about this. And I thought the tone is really vile and vicious. And it's like, where does that come from? Who would say this? Like, I don't know, a bad parent or a scorned lover, or, it's like somebody's nasty inner voice. Like, that's the only way that you get that horrible. It's like talking to them as they're squirming in self-loathing, which is so clever and disquieting. Like, people who have been abused will often blame themselves. And this is in a brilliant, bouncy, sing-along bit of glam pop. So the dissonance is incredible. And it's so marbled with ambiguities as well. And people take the piss out of Brett, sometimes correctly, for his lyrics. But this is such a deceptively clever bit of songwriting. You know, it could be moralizing or finger wagging, or it could be envious or belittling or admiring. You know, everything is, you know, if you call someone an animal, it could be a great compliment in a sexual sense, or completely damning, like, what's wrong with you? You've lost all your humanity. It could be a pet, really sort of dehumanizing, taking away their agency, or elevating them to the status of an ancient god.
Ooh.
It's very sophisticated and daring. Like, now you're over 21.
Yeah.
Okay, so now you're legally free to fuck who you want, or you're already over the hill for the kind of sketchy guys you know, and the self-loathing deepens. Like, is this about freedom and pleasing yourself, or now your animal's gone, or is it about the inexorable trap of formative experience? And when the cage is opened, you just stay in it. You know, this unhealthy, unpleasant, violent, exploitative, drug-fueled, pain-racked, illegal relationship was your first, and you hated it, and it fulfilled you, and you loved it, and it destroyed you. And now it's over. Nothing is ever going to feel so good and so wrong again. Nothing's ever going to make you feel anything again. What does that say about you? What sort of creature are you? What does it take to turn you? You know, it's so kind of crawling, creeping with all this extremely uncomfortable stuff. And I love it.
Yeah,
I think you're completely right about that dissonance, because we're looking at Suede. They're this young, sexy band singing about sex. You expect them to write in a kind of randy way. Do you know what I mean? but instead, it's really fucking bleak. And like Sarah, I can't even say the lyrics without almost bursting into song. But the idea of, you know, what does it take to turn you on? You know, the idea of being unable to get it up, essentially, it runs so counter to this strutting, sexy band that they were. And that is what's so brilliant about it. And at the end, this supposedly brutal lover that the subject of the song had is described as an animal. You know, he's just an animal. There's a real venom to when he does it live, because in the live version, he always sings, he's just a fucking animal. Then the hand clips, you know, he really goes for it at that moment. I just completely endorse everything that Sarah just said. It's a brilliant, brilliant lyric.
Mm. I love the fact that even the fact that it isn't clear exactly what position he's... I mean, it's kind of suspended judgment in some ways, but also it's not clear who the character is or where the voice is coming from. And I think that's another thing that kind of destabilises you as you're listening to it. But it's all held together with this brilliant, brilliant pop tune.
I wonder if it's the same animal as in the song Animal Lover on the album, where Brett sings, I heard you being inside, but what were you in for?
Right.
Yeah, so just a bit of speculation.
What's happened to him? Where has he gone? Did he leave? Is he in prison? Is he dead? What has happened?
Yeah.
And they put this on a Thursday evening when kids are watching. Fucking hell.
It's so obviously dirty. Mm. It's like, that's sex, isn't it? That's some sex. Don't know what's going on, but it's sex.
But yeah, I mean, the way we're going on, we ought to round this up by saying that they became the biggest band of the 90s and became so influential and everything. And, what happened?
Yeah, I mean, they were sort of the trailblazers for Britpop, but they got steamrolled by other bands, including, I mean, it must have been gutting for them that Blur in particular became bigger than Suede. How must that have felt? Mm. But Oasis as well. Mm. And then, obviously, Suede was scuppered for a little while by the fact that Bernard left and they had to bring in a new guitarist who was this untried 17-year-old kid, Richard Oakes, who was actually brilliant, but it sort of dented their credibility in the eyes of some people. So that even when they were bringing out their absolute masterpiece of a second album, Dogman Star, it felt a little bit like they were holed below the waterline. Mm. You know, it really did. And then when they actually made it big again, the third time round with Coming Up, it felt like they were riding on the coattails of Oasis, which is so wrong.
Yeah.
But it just felt like, well, the world is now ready for guitar-based bands. Mm. And Suede had toned it down by this point. He was wearing sensible shirts rather than blouses and pearls. Ugh. And his onstage persona was a bit more geezerish, I remember. So it was a bit sad that in order to get the success that was really overdue, they had to sort of play by Brit rock or dad rock's rules. But we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves. But yeah, basically, as you hint there, Al, they never did become the sort of all-conquering dominant force that they should have done. Mm. But it felt like they were going to.
Yeah.
Them and the Manics, Suede and the Manic Street Preachers, were the two bands in the early 90s that I thought, fucking sign me up. This is my army. I'm joining that army. I will fight to the death for you guys. it was a cause to get behind, Suede and the Manics. Mm. And I remember once, because I was always writing about both those bands in Melody Maker, I remember once being at some kind of music biz after party and Matt Osman approaching me and saying, come on, Simon, you've got to tell me, who do you prefer, us or the Manics?
Ooh.
And I paused and I said, I'm sorry, but it's the Manics. And he said, I knew it, I knew it.
Do you think your lot over-egged it with Suede? Because apparently they were on 18 magazine covers before their album even came out.
It creates a lot of resentment if you hype up a band that much and say they're the best new band in Britain, even if they are plainly the best new band in Britain.
Mm.
And yeah, maybe it was too much too soon. And some of the front covers didn't do them any favours. There was the infamous Select magazine cover, which superimposed Brett on the Union Jack. I think we might even have mentioned that in a previous episode. And Brett didn't want anything to do with that sort of flag-waving bullshit, even though culturally Suede were part of the fight back. They were very much the fight back of British references and a British kind of indie glam sensibility against that kind of chest-beating, hairy, macho American rock that the grunge represented.
Mm.
But they didn't want to, you know, be involved in this stupid fucking almost keep calm and carry on business that Britpop became. Do you know what I mean?
What would an American reader think of that cover? Some bloke slapping his arse and saying,
and it says, Yanks go home, which he never said, of course. I mean, I don't really know what Brett's opinion was of grunge bands. It doesn't really matter. But it kind of done them any favours. I don't even know if, you know, that magazine reached the United States. But if it did, it cannot have done them any favours. No. But then Suede are a classic example of one of those British bands who are only going to appeal to Anglophiles on the coasts in the States.
I love that they were the London Suede.
Yes, because... it's a better name. The London Suede is a better name. I've got a copy of Stay Together that's credited as the London Suede, and it's one of my most prized Suede possessions. I love it. It's a good name. Amazing. I always call them the London Suede. I'm surprised I haven't been doing it all the way through this chat, actually.
It's weird to me, the Union Jack thing, because obviously it would have been way worse if it had just been an English flag.
Oh, God.
Because you just none of that. But I do think of Suede as a very English band, specifically. Mm. They show a route to not taking pride in Englishness, but pleasure and a release of shame. It's like an inversion or a subversion of that kind of English shame about, you know, empire and sex and everything in between, you know. And they kind of mine, that's a seam that they mine, you know. And it's got nothing to do with jingoism or exceptionalism. And there's so many things about Englishness that they kind of correct. They don't really satirise it and they don't really dismiss it. They just kind of offer some sort of alternative to it. And there's so much about them that you don't instinctively associate with the English, like, you know, lusciousness and, you know, lasciviousness, but just, I don't know, there's kind of upgrade to Englishness that they have. Like, we are a dirty, grubby people and they know that and they haven't cleaned that up. They've just kind of excavated under it to find the really good stuff, to find the sort of depth. Man, that's... Suede is such a fascinating band, and it's way beyond the wit of me to make full sense of them, but I completely get it.
It's really weird and counterintuitive now in 2023 to be talking about any kind of positive Britishness, because it's just been so soiled by Brexit and everything that came with it. But at the time, I think Suede, as Sarah says, and also I would say Saint Etienne did a really good job of it. And Saint Etienne were doing it slightly before Suede. They were kind of curating an alternate Britishness of cool 70s junk shop glam records that everyone's forgotten, or, you know, footballers that everyone's forgotten, and neighbourhoods in London that don't normally get mentioned, and stuff like that. This is Saint Etienne I'm talking about now. I think Bob and Pete and Sarah presented a kind of positive Britishness, and Suede came along and did a similar thing in a slightly different way, because Suede were not ones to sort of name drop anything. Their lyrics are quite universal, but they did come from that hinterland outside London. That's it's neither London nor the coast. It's sort of between London and Brighton. And I've written about The Cure in a similar way, but I first picked up on this when I was reviewing the Suede B-side compilation, Sci-Fi Lullabies. Suede, by the way, wrote fucking brilliant B-sides. Their B-side album, it's a double album, and it's better than most people's fucking studio album. But in writing that a review of that, I was saying that there are all these places, these sort of dormitory towns that are just within reach of London, where you can see the lights of London almost down the railway track, but you're not quite there. So Colchester with Blur, Croydon, Saint Etienne, Haywards Heath, Suede, and so on. And I really think, and Crawley for The Cure, but
Woking,
Woking, absolutely, the Jam, but Suede are a bit more similar to The Cure in that they don't name check British stuff. Their sensibility is uniquely English, but they are at least allowing a door open for anyone in the world to kind of get it, think, if they share that sensibility.
Yeah. Deep within it, there's something about otherness and, you know, not belonging anywhere, which is the experience of a lot of people who just desperately want to go to London. Then they go to London, it's like, yes, I've made it. Oh, fuck. Because London will never let you in either. I mean, it will tolerate your presence, but it is as brutal as nature. You can never really be a part of it. And you go, oh, no. And so there's a whole country of people who don't feel they belong. And Suede, they are of that thing as well, very much.
And the other thing about Suede is you can't really lump them in with anyone else. I mean, every time I see on Facebook some flyer for another fucking Britpop night, they've always got this collage of Noel and Liam and Damon and Jarvis and, you know, Mr. Motivator and the Spice Girls. Yeah. And then you see Brett Anderson there and you just think, what are you doing there? You might as well take him out and replace him with a cutout of Hulk Hogan because he doesn't belong there either.
This is the thing about not fitting in anywhere. It is a hard road to tread, but it has its compensations. I think they transcend Britpop now and they did then. You know, like the context that they have now is still their own, and it always was. And I think, yeah, obviously they suffered for it, but they've kind of come through it and outlasted it in the largest way. Obviously, there was the kind of manufactured Blur versus Oasis thing at the centre of, supposedly at the centre of Britpop, but it's really kind of Suede and Pulp or Blur and Oasis, isn't it? You know, it's that's kind of how it's separated out.
Yeah. Whatever backlash there was against Suede in a year or so's time was down to them not selling enough records. That was the big slag off about them.
Yeah, it's like, haha, I got you. You think you're so big and clever. Well, why aren't you number one? You know, Oasis number one. Why aren't you number one? Yeah, yeah, there's all that.
Yeah.
By the way, Sarah mentions Suede outlasting all the bullshit. I've got to add here that of all the bands who have split up and then got back together and maybe playing sort of nostalgic heritage gigs, Suede are the one who have made fucking brilliant new albums since getting back together. It's extraordinary. The first one, okay, the first one, Blood Sports, was kind of finding their feet. It sounds like a Suede album. It's just them basically saying, yep, we can still make a Suede-y kind of record. But the three they've done since then are grand artistic statements. They are incredible. Mm. Really ballsy of them to do that, and actually way better than the final album of their first incarnation, which is A New Morning, which shamefully I gave a 5 out of 5 review to just out of loyalty, really, because it was not a very good album.
Yeah, I think Brett has disowned that one now, hasn't he?
Yeah. But yeah, seriously, of all the comeback bands, you know, normally, like when Pixies came back, the first couple of tours, fucking incredible to see them sounding better than ever before. But then it's like the dreaded thing of like, well, here's our new album. It's like, No. We don't. But Suede are the exception. They really are.
I mean, technically, you could say they're a heritage band at this point, but they don't feel like that at all. Yeah. Like, I mean, for one thing, Brett's voice hasn't changed at all, and their hearts are still in it. They've found a new way to be the band that they are. And I think there's still, they've maintained a kind of sincerity and an innocence somehow and a beauty that is quite magical, really. They're such a special band. I love what has become of them. It's really wonderful.
Yeah, they could totally just be phoning it in at this point. But no, as we're recording this, I'm going to see Suede in a couple of days' time.
Ooh.
And I've seen them earlier this year, and they are terrifying as a live act right now. I mentioned before that Brett is only 4 days younger than me. And you see the fucker, right? He comes, he looks incredible. He comes swaggering out on stage. I love how cocky he is, by the way. Like even now, he's still like ridiculously
starry. He's an elegant
sir. He is an elegant sir in a Tervaline shirt. Yeah. So he sort of struts out on stage. He's got this little wooden box with white gaffer tape around the edge so he doesn't fall off that he jumps up on, and he uses it to sort of propel himself just so that his onstage jumps are that bit higher. And, you know, he goes into the crowd, people sort of tearing at him, and it's so physical. He's just got so much incredible energy about him. It's feral is what it is. I remember a couple of years ago when he first started pulling this shit out of the box and performing like that, my wife and I saw them at Hammersmith Apollo, and my wife turned to me and said, is he all right? Is he dying? Because she thought it was the performance of a dying man who just wanted to fucking put it all out there one last time. But he's doing that. No. He's doing that every fucking night at the moment at the age of 56. Jesus. I just can't get my head around it. He is a phenomenon.
Cool. Yeah.
The best thing that happened in the afterlife of this song, and I don't know if you've seen this, do the words or the word gay penis bum mean anything to you?
Separately, yes. Together, not so much.
Oh my God, have you got a treat in store? Right, okay. So there's this guy On Twitter, he was called Collincidence, but he somehow had his account suspended. I don't know what he's done wrong. And on YouTube, he's Colin Surname. And his YouTube account is still there. What he did, he's a fucking genius, this guy. He made a mockumentary, if you will, about Suede called The Insatiables.
Right.
And it starts off with a voiceover that goes, in 1989, Brett Wood Anderson and Matwell Osman advertised in the NME wanting to form a band for people who pretend they're gay to listen to. I should say for a start, I'm pretty certain that Colin is gay himself, so you know. And it continues, Brett combines the homoerotic charisma of 70s frontmen with the homoerotic charisma of 80s frontmen. And then there are these little snippets of Suede songs that he's kind of adapted. So Animal Nitrate is changed to Gay Penis Bum. And it goes, oh, what turns me on? Oh, gay penis bum, because I'm homosexual. And this went kind of viral, right? And the next gig that actual Suede played in Dublin, Brett actually sang it like that. Brett sang Gay Penis Bum at the gig. I mean, who says Suede don't have a sense of humour? see, comic relief, right? That is actually funny,
yes.
Okay?
Yeah. Yes.
I think it's I do think it's okay to write in character, even if it's not directly from your experience. Yeah. I think Brett Anderson was not the first person to do this and will not be the last, you know. It's fine. You know, Kate Bush was not actually a fetus during nuclear war. Yeah. But it's fine. Yeah.
So the following week, Animal Nitrate stayed at number 7 and would get no further. But Suede became the fastest selling debut LP since Welcome to the Pleasure Dome by Frank Air and entered the album chart at number 1. The follow up, So Young, only got to number 22, but they'd go on to have 7 more top 10 hits throughout the 90s and 2 more number 1 LPs.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Lang made the top 40 last year, duetting with Roy Orbison for Crying. Now solo and on its second release, Constant Craving is at 21 and Life by Satellite from Hawaii.
Were transported straight from Listen Green to a shot of some apartments on the coast of Honolulu as Franklin brags on about the BBC satellite capabilities as we drop in on a live performance of Constant Craving by K.D. Lang. Born in Edmonton, Canada in 1961, Catherine Dawn Lang was relocated to the village of Consort in Alberta at the age of 9 months, where she would grow up. While attending Red Deer College and becoming obsessed with Patsy Cline, Lang decided to have a go at a singing career, moving back to Edmonton after graduating in 1982 and forming a tribute band called The Reclines, which played a sort of country venues in the city, whilst finding time to do a 7-hour performance piece reenactment of Barney Clark's artificial heart transplant, it says here in Wikipedia, citation needed. In 1984, the Reclines, now called KD Lang and the Reclines, put out the LP A Truly Western Experience, and she'd release another with them before she went solo in 1986 and worked with Dave Edmonds on the LP Angel with a Lariat. A year later, Lang was approached by Roy Orbison to duet with him on a re-recording of his 1961 single Crying for the soundtrack to the film Hiding Out, which got to number 2 in Canada and won a Grammy, but did nothing over here. And it would take a performance during the closing ceremony of the 1988 Winter Olympics in Calgary to get Lang on British television when she sang the Alberta Rose. In 1992, Lang put out the LP Ingenue, and this, the follow-up to Barefoot, which failed to chart, was the lead-off single, which got to number 52 over here in May of that year. But then two things happened. The first one was an interview with the American LGBT magazine Advocate in June, where Lang proclaimed she was playing goaltender for the other ice hockey team, or whatever term they use in Canada. And then a re-release of Crying caught on in the UK and went all the way to number 13 in August. In the wake of increased interest in her, Constant Craving was re-released, and last week it entered the chart at number 37. This week it soared 16 places to number 21, which has inspired Stanley Appel to fire up the satellite and send it over Hawaii for a live performance of the song, presumably before a gig or summer. And, you know, I feel Top of the Pops have missed a trick here, chaps, because, you know, people of that era would have seen those white apartments after being told that they were in Hawaii and immediately put two and two together. So what you should have done was a sped up camera zoom towards the balcony and have KD Lang standing there dressed up in a suit like Jack Lord for that Hawaii Five-O opening credits vibe. That would have been nice. Panel, we've already experienced this sort of thing with Etta James 3T and Montel Jordan, haven't we? You know, it's that pop star you've heard about, but singing live in that America where they make all the films. But it's got to be said that the thrill of live transatlantic broadcasting is, it's worn right off by the early 90s, hasn't it? I mean, Madness introducing House of Fun live from Japan a mere 9 years previous. That was an absolute fucking mind blast, wasn't it?
Mm.
But things like this by 1993, see, the thrill's gone. Hasn't it?
Yeah, there's a kind of weird flatness and a fuzziness about the Satellite Top of the Pops performances that just kind of, I don't know what it is, it always feels very remote.
I think they fucked it. I think they fucked it up because, yeah, it's live in Hawaii. But what we get is this establishing shot of Hawaii from the air. It's almost like proto-drone footage of beaches and hotels. But then we cut and it's just KD sat on her own in the dark. She could have been anywhere.
Yeah.
And it comes back, there's a guitar break later on where we see some more irrelevant footage of the flora and mountains of Hawaii, but there's no connection between that and the actual performance. It's
get her
really
out
odd.
On the beach. Because I remember, Simon, previously you were talking about going to see your first gigs and being disappointed that they didn't sound as good as the records. And you almost always get the same feeling when a Satellite performance was trotted out. It just feels like the talent shows they have today, which are about seeing if someone could reach a standard.
Yeah.
You know, like Torvill and Dean doing their compulsories. And here we're being told to just sit back and see if this artist can actually do it without all that studio trickery and computers and whatnot.
Well, the thing is, I don't know if you've noticed this, but it doesn't have the backing vocals where she harmonises with herself. And it made me realise that her harmonising with herself on the record totally makes it, you know? And when you don't have that, I mean, it's a very sparse backing here as well. Sometimes it's barely more than drums. I mean, I've got opinions on the song which come to you, but I just think that choice to make her do it very solo like that loses something, I think.
I don't disagree, but it is also a very, very good performance. Like, she makes it look so easy. Like, this is obviously what this person is supposed to be doing. And she's sitting down, which is not the best position for singing.
No.
She's in total command of her instrument. You know, she ad-libs just a little bit, just to give a few moments a kind of a little curl or a little tickle, and so you know it's live.
Yes.
And she doesn't overextend herself for the high notes. I mean, it does lose something in the chorus.
Yeah.
you're right, because there's usually that, I will not attempt it myself, but it is missing that high note a bit. But she's not overextending herself. She's probably has to save her voice for like more important stuff she's got happening, to be honest.
There's a very sound checky vibe about it, isn't there?
Yeah, but you know, if that was a sound check while you were in the place, you'd sit and listen to the whole thing, wouldn't you?
Yeah, it's got to be said, the lowercase Canadian can piss this sort of thing out of her arse all day, can't you? So it's no burden to sit through this. She's there sat on the edge of a platform in a Harley Davidson t-shirt underneath a denim shirt, and she's much better served by the video, which appears to be set in a Jim Rose circus like performance during the Depression.
It's meant to be Waiting for Godot, isn't
it?
Mark Romanek is a really good director. It's supposed to be a theatrical premiere of Waiting for Godot is the premise of it.
But as far as satellite broadcasts from Top of the Pops go, we've seen far, far worse, haven't we?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And it does show she has a fantastic voice. Not that I ever particularly doubted that.
No.
It really does. Even though it's a shame that there aren't two of her, one harmonising with the other, it's still really impressive from that point of view. And I really surprised myself with my reaction to this, because I think I was a bit anti-KD Lang back in the day. Not for any massive reason, but part of it was the lowercase lettering. It was like E.E. Cummings, which was such a fucking annoying affectation.
Dreamhampton.
Yeah, or a late 80s sandwich bar in Islington that thinks it's something special and is called something like Refuel. You know, that's what it reminded me of. The whole conceit of lowercase lettering was a very sort of trendy middle class thing in that period. And it kind of rubbed me up the wrong way.
Is it? I didn't realise that a case had a class. That's,
Oh, yes. Oh, trust me.
It was kind of styled after E.E. Cummings. And I think for the same reason, which was to separate the kind of performance self from the person. It is a bit annoying, but it's not like the audience grade annoying where it's like, oh, it's all one word, oh no, what am I going to do? It's like wearing sunglasses, isn't it? Sunglasses at night, but I don't want people staring in my eyes all the time.
The enemy of Microsoft Word spell check, isn't it?
Yes.
She might as well have had a red wobbly line underneath her name as well.
Yeah, because it is quite attention seeky in a way. We have to tackle the lesbian elephant in the room.
Yes! Lesbian elephants, come on.
Well, this is another reason why I was maybe slightly set against her. Not because I'm a massive homophobe. No, what it is, right? It was obviously very important at the time that she was a visible lesbian woman in pop, and she was a pioneer of that. And also, not a fun lesbian like you get in porn or in Katy Perry videos.
Fun lesbian.
A serious and real lesbian woman like you get in life, okay? And there weren't many about in the pop landscape of the late 80s, early 90s.
Who was there? Who was there in 1993? Who was out?
All right. Well, there was Frank with a PH.
Right.
There was the Indigo Girls. And that was about it. I mean, some would have mentioned or guessed Michelle Shocked, but she doesn't identify as lesbian. Tracy Chapman has never confirmed her sexuality. So KD Lang was way out in front on that score. And because of that, because she was that important figure, you felt at the time there was a moral imperative coercing you to like her.
Right.
I'm very resistant to that sort of thing. So, yeah, I think I probably just rolled my eyes at the fucking, first of all, the lowercase lettering. And secondly, this kind of, there was an edge to, if people said, do you like KD Lang? There's a certain edge to the question of like, if you don't like her, then you're a bigot. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Are you or are you not a friend of Catherine?
Exactly. So I suppose I hadn't given her any thought for decades until we chose to look at this episode of Top of the Pops. And what I would never ever think over all those years was, what I need now is to hear Constant Craving by KD Lang. But I heard it and it just made me stop in my tracks for a moment. It feels like a song with significant emotional heft. It feels important in the same way that the Suede song feels important. Even lines like, maybe a great magnet pulls all souls towards truth, has a profundity to it, you know? And this was probably the big shock of the episode for me was, oh wow, I really like Constant Craving by KD Lang.
And it was definitely played upon, if not necessarily by her, because in 1993, nobody gave the slightest bit of a fuck about a country singer in Britain. But a country music singer from Canada who didn't eat meat and was a lesbian as well. That's a lot of hooks you can hang things on, isn't it?
Well, that takes balls, being a gay woman or a gay man in the world of country music.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, man. And also, the whole thing about opposing the meat trade, that she's vegetarian, and she actually launched that Meat Stinks campaign. And given that she grew up in Alberta, which is a cattle ranching state, as we know, and she ended up getting banned from more than 30 radio stations in Alberta and more than a dozen in the US.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw this bit, but there was a sign in her hometown of Consort which said, home of K.D. Lang. That was burned to the ground. And she was actually denounced by Alberta's agriculture minister for her supposed betrayal. I mean, fucking hell.
Yeah. It's like the Wurzels doing Meat is Murder, isn't it?
Right, exactly.
And being gay.
But talking about the whole sexuality thing and her kind of androgyny and her status as an icon of that, a few months after this song, there's that famous August 93 issue of Vanity Fair.
Oh, yes.
With that photo of her on the cover in a barber's chair being shaved with a razor by Cindy Crawford.
Yeah,
stuff like that in a pre-internet age, that was big. I really think so.
Yeah,
because by 1993, it was kind of accepted, even if it was grudgingly by most people, that gay men weren't going to go away and just wanted to get on with it. And obviously, being at university at the time, you know, I was massively aware about same-sex palaver going on. There'd be people at college that you knew who were gay or had suspicions that they were gay, but they mainly kept it on the down low. But at uni, lads would be coming out left, right and centre.
Yeah.
And the ones who were already out, some of them practically went into orbit, you know, especially when you were living in London.
Yeah, yeah.
But that option didn't seem to be available to the women folk who were that way inclined. You know, after I graduated, there were at least three women I knew and linked up with afterwards. And, you know, they sat me down and told me that they were lesbians. And I always had to say, yeah, everybody knew, Doc. So for someone like K.D. Lang to come out back then, even if it was before she was really known over here, it must have been a massive deal.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't hurt that she looks like a really cute member of the Undertones. You know, one of my mates was telling me that he went to a K.D. Lang gig and it was absolutely full of women who were just screaming at her as if she was Donny Osmond right the way through.
Wow.
I can imagine, yeah.
Yeah, these things are important in the culture, aren't they? And, you know, I think she can be proud of the part she played, but also she was just living her life. There was another photo shoot with her as Elvis, wasn't there?
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I can't remember what that was for, but that was brilliant.
Mm. And I suppose we got used to the idea of gay male pop stars in the 80s, haven't we?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I think everybody was on board with that. It's like, even if it was grudgingly, it's like, okay, well, some men are gay and some of those gay men are going to be pop stars and they're going to be very successful ones.
Yeah, more birds for the rest of us, eh?
But yeah, not with women.
The other thing is as well that she is clearly dressing down for this performance, and didn't feel any need to kind of conform to any stereotypical beauty standards in that way. But also her voice is very feminine.
Mm.
She's got this very pure, clear tone to her voice. Mm. She almost sounds like Liza Minnelli, like a sort of Broadway singer, slipping between musical contexts as you listen. I mean, she kind of meandered between genres. I mean, partly because country would not really accept her.
No.
You know, I mean, she lived in Nashville. It's like, that was tough.
You know what, though? For everything I said about country being a difficult place for a gay woman, Roy Orbison choosing, when K.D. was still very early on in her career, to duet with her. Fucking respect to Roy Orbison for that, you know?
Yeah.
That was before she was out, though.
Oh, come on.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, the same as your friends at uni. Come on.
Of course, when you're an LGBT songwriter, everything has an extra layer of meaning. Or, at the very least, other people try to lump on an extra layer of meaning, you know, even when it's not there. You know, like when George Michael was forced out, you'd go over the Wham singles and go, ah, so maybe Club Tropicana was a gay club, or, oh, that's why he didn't want his mate to get married in Young Guns Go For It. Could be true, but it could also be ridiculous, because kind of implies that everything gay people do is entirely determined by their sexuality. It's like seeing George Michael in the papers eating a packet of Frazzles and going, oh, they must be the gay crisps then. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Depends which pocket you put the packet in.
Well, I do think you're right that everything does get given this extra layer. Mm. And I wonder if, I don't want to sort of speak for you, but did you mean by that that constant craving is hinting at the kind of longing and yearning for forbidden fruit?
Yeah,
And that being the situation under which gay people had to basically live for centuries.
You could say it elevates the context of the song from boo-hoo, you don't fancy me because I'm not attractive enough or you with someone else to, oh, fucking hell, you don't fancy me because nature and biology.
Yeah, it's got a sort of echo of, you know, Radcliffe Hall, The Well of Loneliness or something like that. Yeah.
I think, you know, good or great songwriters will generally draw from their own experience, but they will strive to reach others. You know, that's kind of what they do. So a lot of great songs are, it's not that it's ambiguous, it's just that it's expansive and large, and people can relate to it. You know, they'll find something in it to relate to. And if you're a gay person, it's going to be about your own experience as a gay person. But you're also a person and you want to connect with all kinds of audiences.
And we can sit all day pulling apart the semiotics and inner meanings and all that cobblers while millions of other people are coming across it on Radio 2 and thinking, oh, this is lovely.
It is lovely. It is lovely.
And that's it. You know, next time it's on the radio, I will listen because I wouldn't say it's blown my mind, but it's certainly given me a slight slap upside the head that I like this song.
So the following week, Constant Craving jumped 2 places to number 19. And a week later, we get to number 15, its highest position. The follow-up, The Mind of Love, open brackets, Where Is Your Head, Catherine, close brackets, would only get to number 72 in May, and she never got near the top 40 again, but she closed out the year with that cover of Vanity Fair, where she got a shave off Cindy Crawford, and appeared at the Concert of Hope for the National AIDS Trust with George Michael, David Bowie, and Mick Hucknall.
I would just like to ask, why wasn't there a happy hardcore track sampling this called Constant Raving?
It's always great to introduce a band on the show when it's their first time, especially knowing they've worked so hard to get here. From Scotland at number 29, Run Rig with the excellent, wonderful
It's always great to introduce a band on the show when it's their first time, says Franklin off camera again, as we look at a whammy bar being interfered with, especially when they've worked so hard to get here. He's talking about Run Rig and Wonderful. Formed in the Isle of Skye and Glasgow in 1973, when the accordionist Blair Douglas's mam needed a band at short notice for a North Ouston Burneray Association dance in Glasgow and linked her son up with the McDonald brothers, Callum and Rory, the Run Rig dance band spent the first 5 years of their career tearing up the dance halls of the west coast of Scotland with their rocky take on the traditional music of the Highlands and Islands. In 1978, they put out their first LP, Play Gaelic, an entirely Gaelic album, apart from the title, which caused no end of mither with the record label, but caught the mood of much of the country at the peak of the Scottish devolution wave, and the band suddenly became a very big deal north of Hadrian's Wall. It wouldn't be until 1982 that they put out their first single, a cover of the 18th century folk standard Loch Lomond, and it got to number 86 in the UK chart in the first week of 1983. Although they failed to crack the charts on 2 separate occasions in 1984, they spent the rest of the decade consolidating their position as a hugely popular independent band in Scotland. And when they signed a deal with Chrysalis in 1988, they started to gain a following on the continent. And they closed out the decade with their 6 LP Searchlight entering the album chart at number 11 in October of 1989. In 1991, their next LP, The Big Wheel, smashed into the charts at number four. They played a gig to 50,000 people reasonably close to the bonnie banks of Loch Lomond, and they eventually breached the top 40 when the Hot Hammer EP got to number 25 in September of that year. This single, the follow-up to Flower of the West, which got to number 43 in November of 1991, is the lead-off cut from their eighth LP, Amazing Things, which comes out a week tomorrow. And it's a new entry this week at number 29. And here they are in the Elstree studio, making their studio debut on Top of the Pops. And yes, chaps, the music industry may be in crisis at the moment with a drop in record sales, but here's the upside. Bands with a dedicated fan base suddenly having the clout to get their faves into the charts.
What is there to say about Wonderful by Runrig? Seriously, help me.
Well, here's the thing, right? I found Mark Franklin's introduction incredibly patronising when he says, right, so he says, it's always great to introduce a band on the show when it's their first time, especially knowing they've worked so hard to get here. Mm. Hang on a minute, right? Runrig, by this point, had two gold albums and two silver albums and were a massive live act in Scotland.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guarantee you, I don't know if any members of Runrig have ever written their memoirs, but if they have, you will not find any member of Runrig saying that appearing on Top of the Pops in 1993 was a highlight of their career. No fucking way.
No.
Right? But yeah, they are having their Clannad moment. You know, Clannad were massive in Ireland, and then they finally had a hit in the UK with the theme from Harry's Game. Not quite on the same level, but yeah, they're a band whose appeal is very regional or national, I should say, and that's fine. And Top of the Pops is in their context. It's weird seeing them seeing them on there at all.
Yeah.
But for Franklin to imply, oh, this plucky little band, isn't it great? You know, we're doing them a favour. No.
It is his context, though, to be fair, isn't it? Mark Franklin was found in his cradle underneath one of the stages and just, you know, raised by the tea lady. And it's all he knows. It's all he knows. Yeah, a couple of years before this, they had played to 50,000 people in Balloch Country Park. So, yeah, they didn't need this, and they don't need me to be snarky about them either. It's a different sphere, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a different plane of existence that a lot of bands occupy. There are bands who have really good careers that don't interact very much with, you know, occasionally they'll kind of merge with the mainstream and then you don't hear from them again. But that doesn't mean that they cease to exist.
Yeah. I mean, even people in the actual music biz didn't know anything about them. There was an oral history about Red Wedge in Mojo, the Red Wedge tour of 1986, and they were added on the bill during the Scottish leg. And Tom Robinson said, Runrig turned up at Edinburgh Playhouse and most of us didn't have a clue who they were. Then they went out on stage and the whole place went apeshit. Amazing. We were all standing at the side saying, who are these guys? And Donnie Munro, the lead singer, said, it was unusual for us back then to be suddenly thrust amongst all these top chart acts, but we were really delighted to be able to do the show. We did a song called Dance Called America because it was about forced emigration from Scotland and feudalism, and it related to the sense of loss of community that we were experiencing under Thatcherism. So, yeah. They deserve their spot there.
Yeah.
I mean, Simon, as a proud, woad-smeared Celt, you've spoken of your love for Big Country back in the day, and Runrig's always been depicted as the Lafroig to Big Country's bells and teachers. So did you ever dabble?
No, and I don't really see the comparison apart from the fucking tartan shirt.
They shared one member,
did they?
They did share a member with, there's been 12 members of Runrig, I think, across 45 years.
But we're not talking about sort of imperial phase Big Country, are we?
No, I couldn't tell you, actually. I just know that somebody was in both of them.
Fair enough. But no, I can't really, just from this song, yeah, sure, they're wearing tartan or check shirts, but that's about, they look terrible, don't they?
Oh, God. Okay, so what it is, so they've got leather jackets and work trousers on. They've got work trousers and work shoes.
Yeah.
It's like they've just come from the office and they've had to throw on leather jackets to go on Top of the Pops.
And they're not even the right kind of pleated trousers, are they? They're not the David Stubbs ones. They're not semiotic trousers.
Are they? Are they diegetic trousers, though?
And they've got those really bad early 90s shirts under leather jackets. So they all look like a biker gang who only shop at C&A.
Well, one of them's got the biker jacket, but the other, it's a blouson, which is just never good. Oh. It's like Jimmy Nail in Spender or something. It's, oh, fuck me. Mullets as well, some serious mulletage going on.
Yeah.
And they look so old. I mean, the main guy, Donnie Monroe, I looked it up and he's 39 when this is recorded. He looks every day of that, and you can probably add another 15 on top. I mean, fucking
hell. He's the kind of 39 that people used to be in the 50s.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
I didn't watch this episode when it originally came out. So when I realised that Run Rig were on it, I was like, ooh, I'm going to find out what this band are all about. You know, like Crass. Because, you know, you'd see Crass in the late 70s on the walls everywhere and you never heard them. You just thought, oh God, what must they be like? And it wasn't until like the turn of the century that I started listening to Crass. I thought, oh, fucking hell, this is all right. But I can't say the same for Run Rig. I don't know what I was expecting. Probably a musical version of McGlashan out of Absolutely. But, you know, what we get here is a melange of mid-80s windy Celticness and incidental music from an episode of Taggart, don't we?
Yeah, like The Adventures or The Silencers or something like that. Mm. The thing with it is, I don't believe, and this is from my own superficial skim through what Run Rig are about, that this is representative of them as a band.
No.
It happens without anything happening. Mm. There's all one chord for ages at the start and not even a melody to speak of.
No.
You know? And they play their instruments like their display models, and they're trying to play really softly, trying them out, and they'll be handing them back to the shop assistant any second now. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Hey, at least they're not doing Smoke on the Water, though. Give them that.
Or Stairway to Heaven. Yeah, there's kind of the vague atmosphere of rock about it, but there's no emphasis on anything in particular. And there isn't really a riff, and it's not in any particular key, and there isn't really a hook. But other than that, it's great.
Yeah.
Sounds vaguely Christian, doesn't it? It's very... Sorry, but it does.
I think their earlier material would be more spirited and maybe more roots-based than this. But this, it doesn't even have a chorus. It's just got a title that's repeated. So wonderful, too wonderful, so wonderful, too wonderful. It's, oh, come on, guys. So it's kind of surprising that of their entire catalogue, this is the one that gets into the charts. But, you know, what can you do?
Yeah, I don't know what that says about people who buy records, really.
I mean, it's honestly, because Run Rig were often name dropped as, oh, well, you think you know about Scottish rock. Well, wait till you hear Run Rig, you know.
Yes.
So here we are hearing Run Rig. And all I can say is it's just as well that the Jesus and Mary Chain and Mogwai and the Associates and Franz Ferdinand and Orange Juice and Bell and Sebastian and all those other bands exist so that we don't have to judge the rock of Scotland on this one song and this one performance.
Yeah, it's very much the sound of Midland. Scotland, isn't it, this? Yeah. But we get a proper look at the main stage for the first time, and we can see where the BBC's chucked the money. Yeah, it's a properly wide stage, flanked by metallic stairs and balconies to the side, with a huge banker scaffolding at the back. And the band have decorated that with a massive banner, which depicts the cover of their new LP, which is a photo of the Hugh McDiarmid Memorial, created by the artist Jake Harvey. So there is that.
Yeah.
You know, Hugh McDiarmid was a poet and one of the founders of the National Party of Scotland, I discovered.
Great.
So, yeah, a learning experience.
Yeah.
No disrespect to them, who they've had an incredible career and made a lot of people very happy, but they're not a Top of the Pops band, and this is not a Top of the Pops song, and it's not barely even a song, I think.
Yeah.
So, the following week, Wonderful dropped 14 places to number 43. The downside to having a hardcore fan base that buy you shit on week one with no one else there to pick up the slack, and a very chilling portent of the very near future. But by the end of the month, the LP entered the chart at number 2, held off the summit of Ben Chartis by their greatest hits by Hot Chocolate. The follow-up, The Greatest Flame, got to number 35 in May, but they'd go on to score 6 more top 40 hits throughout the 90s and even got to number 9 in November of 2007 when they linked up with the Tartan Army for a revamp of Loch Lomond. In 1997, their lead singer, Donny Munro, who had already served as the rector of the University of Edinburgh at this very moment, left the band in order to run at the general election as the Labour candidate for Ross, Skye and Inverness West, but lost to Charles Kennedy, and the band would put out six more studio LPs and five live LPs before splitting up in 2018. Oh, and Run Rig was a system of arable land tenure from late medieval times, where strips of farmland were rotated amongst villages on a yearly basis so no one could permanently bagsy the most fertile land. Dig it, kids! Well then, pop craze youngsters, I feel that now is as good a time as any to shut the lid on this part of Chart Music 73, but fear not, we'll be back tomorrow for the final furlong of this episode. So, on behalf of Sarah B and Simon Price, this is Al Needham advising you to sit tight, listen keenly, and stay pop crazed.
Chart Music.
Calling all pop craze youngsters. You asked for it. We were offered it. So we said, all right then, fuck it, why not? Saturday, January the 13th, 2024. Birmingham Town Hall. Chart Music live all day. Yes, pop craze youngsters, Chart Music is getting on down to Benny Tan with the power trio of Simon Price, Neil Kulkarni and Al Needham for a full day of Chart Music ramble. We commence with the return of Here Comes Quizem, the Chart Music pub quiz. And then, a 3-hour live episode of Chart Music. And then, we round off the evening with a Chart Music disco, where we dance the night away to the white-hot sounds of Joy Sarnie and Two Man Sound. It do be the complete Chart Music experience, Miss Diane, and can be yours for a mere £15. So, see that internet, mashup.bit.ly/CM24. That's bit.ly/CM24. Lay your money down and be prepared to be pop crazed all day long in beautiful downtown Birmingham. Hey, piss troll, we're coming for you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for ways to win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.